to the infamous stone walls of New Zealand's oldest and most notorious prison. Our guest is the historian Mark Darby, whose latest book is Rock College, an unofficial history of Mount Eden Prison. Nicknamed the Rock, the imposing Victorian fortress-style building incarcerated those found guilty for more than 150 years. It was the site of 36 executions, including New Zealand's last hanging in 1957. Old-fashioned, outdated and much criticised before it finally closed in 2011, it is survived by stories, myths and legends. Mark has heard most, if not all of them. He's in the Auckland studio. Mark, good morning.
Morning, Catherine.
How have you come at this history?
Well, I got the idea for the book after just hearing on the news that it was closing down in 2011. That made me think that someone surely should write its history. I realised when I looked into it a bit that I had already researched the lives of some of those who had been held there. And so I had their prison records and that kind of thing. And it proved to be a really rewarding and nationally important story, I think.
It's a social history broader than a prison and those who dwelled within. The range of political prisoners, as well as some of the most infamous criminals in the country, is quite extraordinary.
I agree. There were conscientious objectors held there in both the First and Second World Wars, and some of the Māori inmates from the New Zealand wars you would have to describe as political prisoners as well, I think.
Right through to the 60s and the protests of the time. Have you ever experienced even a night in prison, by the way?
No, not even a night, no. I have walked through it quite a bit, but no, I've never been held in any prison overnight.
It is sobering then to walk the lives of those who did. And again, you can come at this so many different ways. Did you begin with the stories of the people?
I did. I decided to draw a boundary around the subject and really only to deal with people's lives once they were in the prison. So what they had done to get there and what happened after they left, in general, is not something that the book deals with. But as you say, it's a social history. I really looked at what it meant for those people to be in prison, who was there, who made an impact on the place, and how society itself, I suppose, addressed the changing ways in which prison inmates have been treated.
Its physical presence, though, is very much part of that story. If we come right forward to the many years of campaigning to get rid of it as a prison before it happened in 2011, its physical structure is so imposing. And what was the origin of the building itself? Was it purpose-built to impose and intimidate in the way that it does?
Yeah, absolutely. It replaced an earlier and much smaller and flimsier wooden prison known as the Stockade, and it was put in place to become New Zealand's maximum security prison after the first national inspector of prisons was appointed. He was an Englishman named Hume. He had worked in prisons like Wormwood Scrubs in Britain, and I think he got here and said, this country needs one like that. Mount Eden was chosen as the site for it in part because it's built on a volcanic rock mountain, and it was already a quarry. And so the materials and the means to build the prison were already in place. It was built largely by the inmates out of the materials that they themselves quarried and shaped.
This is in the mid-1870s, I think. By the 1880s, it was ready to accept its first residents. However, that development continued for some years.
It took about 40 years, believe it or not, from woe to go. The prison was built in stages, kind of modular, a wing at a time, and prisoners were transferred successively from the old prison to the new one as soon as the cells became available to receive them.
Was it regarded, in what was then still a relatively young country in its contemporary form, as a national prison?
Yes, it was, I think. It certainly was, but it was also regarded, even before it was completed, as obsolete, as outdated, as unfit for purpose by various observers. They said no effective rehabilitation of inmates would be possible within it. They were right about that.
So who were the early inmates? It's obviously got eras that we will concentrate on, but who were some of those early inmates? What were they there for?
That's the funny thing. It's always been both, for most of its life, it's been both a maximum security prison and the local prison for Auckland. So an entire range of inmates were held there in most periods, from the most petty, trivial, short-term offences right through to the toughest hard men in the country, all mixed together, including women and, in the earlier years, children as well.
Goodness. I'm just reading here of police magistrate Felton Matthews, said to be possessed of stern piety, notoriously hard on the town's many drunks. So people would be put in prison for what would be regarded today as minor offences, if offences at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Imprisoned in the past for activity that would not even be considered abnormal today, let alone criminal. Yeah.
And the presence of children there, how is that explained?
These were little petty thieves, kids who would, you know, pinch a wallet.
Dickensian, quite literally.
Literally, absolutely literally. The youngest would be in the range of about 11. They could not, for most of that time, be kept separate from adult prisoners. And that is a condition which I'm sure was not conducive to their rehabilitation.
And again, in those early years, there was poverty and illness present in the jail, obviously, as well. We really are seeing it as a prison, I guess, of Victorian times. But we move beyond Victorian times. And how does it change, including into, say, the 20s, when we begin to refer to it as Rock College?
Yeah, well, by then it had certainly acquired a kind of mystique among inmates nationally. It was almost a point of pride, I think, among many of them to go there. One sense of the name Rock College is that it was a sort of university of crime, because all sorts of inmates were mixed up together, from first-timers through to old lags. If you were in the exercise yard as a young first-time inmate, you could get a real advanced education in criminal activity, all kinds of information, how to pick a safe, how to impress a judge so as to get a lighter sentence, everything you might need to be a successful professional criminal you could learn in that exercise yard.
So that is contrary, obviously, to the intentions with which the citizenry might want to lock up offenders, but that was the reality. It was regarded with a kind of mystique by criminals at the time?
Yeah, and later. Yeah, no, it certainly, it certainly did acquire an aura of fear. It had a fearsome reputation, but it was in some ways, a point of pride to have been held there, I'd say.
Who are some of the more famous and indeed in some cases notorious inmates whose stories you tell? Who are some you would choose?
Let's see. Ruakenana, the Tuhoi prophet, he springs to mind. He was held there for about 18 months from 1916. Much later, the Māori Battalion commander, Colonel Peter Awatere, was held in the prison. The current mayor of Invercargill, Sir Tim Shadbolt, served a couple of brief sentences in the 1970s. Let me see. As I said, there were conscientious objectors held there in both world wars. Te Kōti was held there briefly in the late 19th century.
Goodness.
Until he was bailed out by his supporters. Juliet Hume, one of the two of the Parker Hume murderers. She was held in the prison and left some vivid accounts of it, which I was able to draw upon.
How did you draw upon the stories of those who had served in there, by the way? Have you been able just to do, in many cases, access diaries or writings that they've left?
I did. And in the case of more recent inmates, I was fortunate enough to be able to talk to them. I talked to a guy known as Diamond Jim Shepherd, yes, former member of the Mr. Asia gang.
Yes.
And Jim and I had many long, rambling conversations by phone. He lives on the Gold Coast now in Australia, doesn't want to come back here. But he was very helpful to me, and in particular, he talked to me about the 1965 riot, in which the inmates pretty much entirely trashed the interior of the prison. He was one of the ringleaders of that riot, and perhaps, you know, one of the last survivors of it.
Guest from many years ago, actually, on the show, Jim Shepherd. And that era, I suppose, this is where we move from. We've talked a lot about the sort of the political protest side of this, but also some of the most notorious, again, eras or criminals have who have become part of the legend of this, and certainly the Mr. Asia era was one of those. But you did touch on something we must discuss, which was those 1960s riots. And what was it that brought those to a head?
The big riot in 1965 actually began as a failed escape attempt. Two young guys on remand attempted to bust out of the prison with a smuggled pistol. They didn't succeed. So they went down into the basement where the longest-serving inmates were held, including George Wilder, a well-known figure, and they let them out with the keys that they obtained from a warder, in the hope that those guys would know how to find a way out of the prison. That didn't succeed. So it turned into a riot. They set fire to everything that would burn. They let all the prisoners they could access out of their cells, and the whole thing turned into a major riot, an extraordinary event. Jim Shepherd likened it to a scene from a Fellini movie in the dark. That's how that riot began, certainly.
Was that indicative of what has been the recurring theme around the prison, just the conditions and the frustrations that mount within?
I would say so. I think that it was a poor, outdated, purely punitive design for a building representing the very worst traditions of penal practice, really. And as a result of that and other factors, but particularly of that, then it has encouraged extreme forms of bad behaviour, really, on both sides.
It is interesting, and I know that Sir Kim Workman has written a comment on the book as part of the blurb. It is interesting how much the approach towards incarceration has changed in recent decades. But if we go back, quite apart from the death penalty, which we'll discuss in a moment, corporal punishment, flogging for petty theft, these kinds of things were prominent through till how late?
Let's see. I'd say flogging was kept up to the 1930s, particularly for sexual offences. Long time before that, back in the 19th century, troublemakers in the prison were treated with extreme brutality at times, sometimes by being gagged for long periods in a very painful fashion. These were absurdly vindictive punishments, and even the warders who inflicted them recognised that they didn't actually work. They didn't encourage better behaviour on the part of the inmates that they were inflicted on.
What was the history of corporal punishment? We mentioned the last, of the death penalty. We mentioned the last execution in 1957. What had the history been up to that point?
We've had a lot of hangings in this country, a lot of executions in in our prisons, and more, I would say, in Mount Eden than in any other. There were plenty of hangings in the early 20th century, and they both at Mount Eden and also in Wellington. And then there was a hiatus from the, I think from memory, from the 1930s onwards, for some years, a decade or so, reintroduced in about 1946 with the election of the first national government, and several more hangings after that until they were finally abolished in 1957. But that last batch of hangings, if you like, were all at Mount Eden. That was the only place in the country where they were carried out.
There was news after the hanging of Bolton, who'd been convicted for the murder of his wife, that the execution had gone horribly wrong. Was that substantiated?
You know, I couldn't really say, but I do know that that the prison authorities were always very concerned that an execution should not be botched in that way, because it created a powerful argument for abolishing the death penalty. Proponents of the death penalty, of hanging, tried to maintain that it was a humane form of killing, that it was more or less instant, it was therefore practically painless, it was more humane than a lengthy prison sentence. It was hard to sustain that argument if you knew that the hanging had been botched and that death was far from instantaneous.
Indeed, Juliet Hume, to which you refer, writes of this, doesn't she? An experience you don't ever want to have again is to be in prison the night before they hang somebody. And I think there was something like 5 executions during her time there. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
What did you learn about the impact of the executions on other inmates and indeed on staff?
It was, I think, traumatic and more or less unforgettable on both groups of people. One of the, oddly enough, one of the, I think, unexpected factors in getting rid of the death penalty finally in this country was that it became increasingly difficult to find staff willing to participate in it. Doctors, for instance, there needed to be a registered medical practitioner present at a hanging, and it became harder and harder to find doctors who would agree to do that. Some staff undoubtedly had nervous breakdowns. Some refused to accept roles that would require them to participate in hangings. That was a factor in bringing the whole practice to an end.
There must have been distress for you in researching some of the details of this history. What were some of the moments that shocked you when you discovered things?
There were, Catherine, no doubt. I learned that in the late 19th century, there was a little subsidiary institution alongside the prison called the Lock Hospital. And this was a shabby little building which held and treated people who had communicable diseases, basically venereal diseases. Pretty much the only patients, as far as I know, were sex workers who were held there to prevent them from infecting people. The youngest patient I know of was aged about 10. And as far as the authorities were concerned, she was the wrongdoer and decent people needed to be protected from her. That was a distressing discovery, but there were plenty. There were, however, also a few heartening stories. there was at least one love story that I discovered between a male and a female inmate. That was surprising and satisfying to be able to describe. But yeah, generally speaking, it's not a happy story, but it's certainly, I think, a genuinely historically significant one.
Some of the earliest campaigners for reform, I'm just trying to find the lady, the formidable lady who's photographed here. Here she is, Mary Colcliffe, is it?
Pronounced Coakley, yeah,
Coakley.
But that's who
yep.
it is, yeah.
And what was her story?
Well, she was one of, perhaps the most impressive, of a whole string of early prison reformers, and particularly concerned about the treatment of women inmates in the prison. And they would do everything that they could to improve conditions for the women while they were in prison. They offered their own homes to these women to stay in as soon as they came out of prison, so that they would have less incentive, less need to reoffend as soon as they came out. They would badger the authorities to say that these women should have better exercise facilities, better living conditions while they were in there. And on the whole, they were, I found very, very impressive figures. Blanche Bowen was another one in the early 20th century, well-known poet, but also an active prison reformer.
What of the building itself now, closed in 2011? I suppose there is the legacy of the prison in the first instance. What would you say for you is its legacy to our social history?
Well, it's a unique building architecturally. It's of great heritage value, I think. But it's also a living rebuke in some ways to the failed policies and practices of the past. It's extraordinary that such a large building in such a prominent site has been standing there empty and unused for almost a decade.
What is its future?
Who knows? No one that I know of, that I've spoken to, seems to have a clear plan for what to do with it.
It's protected, right?
Absolutely. By the highest heritage level category, yeah.
Are there artistic touches within its walls still from all those decades of prisoners?
There are. I mean, the stonework that's gone into aspects of the prison is hugely impressive. Real artisanship, in fact, all carried out by the inmates themselves, pretty much.
And the rumours of a ghost, what's your take, Mark?
I heard lots of ghost stories, and I heard them from very level-headed, non-credulous people, staff mainly of the prison, who said that, yeah, everyone knew that if you worked there, you came across mysterious sounds and experiences in the course of the night, especially on night shift. It was hard to dismiss these stories as just sheer nonsense, because they were told by people who didn't scare easily. People who work in a prison like that are not the type to get jumpy about funny noises.
The contractor who was in for emergency repairs and swears an inmate appeared behind him and yelled, "Get the F out." Yeah. And the one that creeps me out is the lone loudspeaker that continues to crackle and moan despite the PA system being closed down.
I heard that, yeah. I heard that from several different people who heard that loudspeaker.
Fascinating stuff, Mark. Thank you very, very much. It's certainly a labour that's gone into producing the book. Thank you, Mark Darby, Rock College, An Unofficial History of Mount Eden Prison. And therefore those who've worked or been housed within over many, many, many years. 150 of them, in fact.